Chapter 3. Japanese Around the World. From 1638 to 1868, during the rule of the Tokugawa shoguns, emigration from Japan was forbidden on pain of death. However, there was significant emigration both before and since. In 1606, there were 3,000 Japanese living in Manila alone, and several times that number in the Philippines as a whole. There was also Japanese emigration to Korea as early as the 15th century, and by the 17th century, there were many Japanese communities in the countries of Southeast Asia. The Meiji Restoration's many changes included a resumption of emigration from Japan in the latter half of the 19th century. Despite its proximity to the Asian mainland, modern Japan's emigrants initially went primarily to the Western Hemisphere. As of 1900, more than half of all Japanese living abroad lived either on the mainland of the United States or in Hawaii, mostly the latter. After the tightening of U.S. immigration restrictions in the early years of the 20th century, the stream of Japanese emigrants shifted toward South America, notably Brazil and Peru. In short, before the creation of Japan's overseas empire, modern Japanese emigrants sought the higher-income European offshoot nations of the Western Hemisphere. Even within its own Pacific region, more than three-quarters of the Japanese emigrants in that part of the world at the beginning of the 20th century lived in another European offshoot nation, Australia. Two things were to change this international distribution of Japanese emigrants, however. Immigration restrictions by the recipient countries in the Western Hemisphere, Australia and South Africa, and the development of an overseas Japanese empire in Asia. Early in the 20th century, Canada, Australia, South Africa, and various countries in Central America and the Caribbean joined the United States in severely restricting immigration from Japan. This shifted the stream of Japanese emigrants toward South America, where they were initially welcomed by countries with much undeveloped land and few people willing or able to develop it. However, by the mid to late 1930s, South American countries also began to restrict immigration from Japan. Meanwhile, Japan's conquest of such areas as Korea, Manchuria, and Formosa during the late 19th and early 20th centuries provided new outlets for its emigrants. These conquests led to a great increase in the number of Japanese living overseas, as well as changing their global distribution. No longer were they concentrated in European offshoot societies. As of 1935, there were more than a quarter of a million Japanese each in Manchuria and Formosa, and well over half a million in Korea, compared to about half a million in the entire Western Hemisphere, and less than 200,000 in Southeast Asia. While Australia's whites-only immigration policy, initiated in 1901, reduced the numbers of Japanese in that country to fewer than 2,000. The historic change in the overseas destinations of Japanese emigrants was dramatic. Whereas Manchuria received only 2% of Japanese emigrants between 1924 and 1934, it received 85% of all Japanese emigrants from 1935 to 1945. By 1940, there were 1.7 million Japanese living abroad, of whom 1.2 million lived in Asia. Those who lived in Japan's conquered territories were primarily government officials, industrial and transport workers, and businessmen, in short, representatives of the modern urban world. By contrast, those who settled in the Western Hemisphere were primarily agricultural laborers or farmers. Moreover, the Japanese who emigrated at different periods represented also different stages in the evolution of modern Japan. A modern Japanese scholar has said, "If you want to see Japan of the Taisho era, 1912 to 1926, go to Brazil. If you want to see Japan of the Meiji era, 1868 to 1912, go to America." This difference was dramatically demonstrated during World War II, when Japanese Americans loyally supported the United States despite receiving harsh treatment as enemy aliens, while the Japanese in Brazil, treated much better, remained so fanatically pro-Japan that many of them refused to believe that Japan had been defeated, even after its unconditional surrender in 1945. Thousands of Japanese in Brazil waited in port for the arrival of victorious Japanese military forces in the Western Hemisphere. In both the United States and Brazil, The responses of the Japanese reflected the inner patterns of a people rather than the effect of the surrounding society. Japan itself was quite different at the different times when they emigrated, very pro-Western in general and pro-American in particular during the earlier era, and fanatically nationalist and racist during the later era. In the wake of Japan's defeat in World War II, vast numbers of Japanese returned from Japan's overseas empire, now liberated by Allied troops. Nearly 500,000 returned from Formosa, Taiwan, more than 500,000 from South Korea, approximately 700,000 from Southeast Asia, 1,000,000 from Manchuria, and 1.5 million from the conquered regions of China. This massive return of Japanese to their homeland took place over a period of about a decade following the end of the war, most arriving in a period of a year and a half following the end of the war. Altogether, these returnees amounted to more than 6 million people. Japan. The history of Japan has been remarkable in a number of ways, and in some ways unique. Japan remained isolated from the rest of the world for 2 centuries. Before American naval power forced the Japanese government to open up their ports to the outside world in 1854. Japan is also one of the few major nations of modern times to have a racially homogeneous population. Until 1945, the Japanese were also one of the few major nations or races never to have been conquered. Japan is often thought of as a small country, but its area is larger than that of Great Britain, though smaller than that of California. Japan's vast economic output has tended to cause it to be compared to giant countries such as the United States and Russia, the only nations with a larger total output, and hence to be seen as little. But Japan is larger than a number of European nations, including Italy as well as the United Kingdom. In the past, Japan's successful wars against China, 1895, and Russia, 1905, likewise led to size comparisons with huge nations. In terms of people, rather than land area, Japan has the 7th largest population in the world, though less than half the population of the United States, and a small fraction of the population of China or India. Japan's gross national product is larger than that of all Latin America or the entire continent of Africa. In another sense, however, Japan is smaller than it appears to be. Its hills and mountains leave relatively little land suitable for agriculture, and it has little of the natural resources required by a modern industrial economy: iron ore, coal, petroleum, copper, lead, and zinc, all of which have to be imported. Yet this meager natural resource base has to support the most densely populated major nation in the world. Land suitable for farming has not only been scarce, but scattered, in narrow river valleys or in mountain basins, or along a coastal strip, so that Japan developed historically as a fragmented collection of settlements and domains. Even after a unified nation emerged, its prefect boundaries generally followed lines of natural geographic barriers that had historically divided the country. Japan's rivers were usually navigable only for short distances, and so did not serve to knit the land together. The sea was Japan's great waterway, however, which meant that the coastal areas were in communication, even if the hinterlands were not. Still, no part of Japan is more than 70 miles from the sea, though that distance was more formidable in the centuries before the modern transportation revolution. Before the coming of Western science and technology, Japan was a poor country, and remained so for many years, even after its military power became impressive in the late 19th century. It has also been, historically, an isolated country. Just as Britain was once isolated by being off the mainland of Europe, Japan's historic development has taken place off the mainland of Asia, but several times farther off. Although Chinese cultural influences penetrated and transformed Japan more than 1,000 years ago, Japan remained an isolated nation, developing, adapting, and modifying the Chinese cultural contributions in its own way. Until the development of ocean-going commerce in recent centuries, Japan had only the most intermittent contact even with Korea and China, much less with the world at large. There has been virtually no significant immigration into Japan, and the non-Japanese peoples in the country amount to less than 1% of its population. The forcible destruction of Japan's isolation by American naval vessels under Commodore Perry in 1854 was a turning point in Japanese history. It also demonstrated, with painful clarity, Japan's weakness and backwardness compared to advanced Western industrial nations, and set the national agenda for Japanese development in the century that followed. Imitation of the West, admiration of the West, resentment of the West, and both national and racial ambivalence toward the West dominated Japanese thought and action in the generations that followed Perry's fateful opening of Japan to the outside world. The United States, as the country powerful enough to break through Japan's historic isolation, was a special focus of Japanese attention. The American way of life was praised by Japanese leaders and intellectuals of the Meiji era. The United States was depicted as a benefactor to Japan by ending its isolation, and government-issued textbooks held up Abraham Lincoln and Benjamin Franklin as models to be imitated, even more so than Japanese heroes. English was introduced into Japanese secondary schools in 1876, and there was even a suggestion that it be made the national language. Euphoric descriptions of the United States as an earthly paradise were part of a general depiction of Western peoples and nations as enviable, beautiful, and great. Some enthusiasts not only adopted Western fashions, but even engaged in sweeping denigrations of all aspects of Japanese culture. Alongside such feelings, however, alternating with them and eventually overpowering them, was a growing Japanese desire to prove themselves and to assert their own identity and mastery. By the early 20th century, Japan had changed radically to become an ultra-nationalistic country, shrill and belligerent toward other nations and fanatically devoted to their emperor. The Japanese themselves often saw these traits as defensive overcompensations for a sense of inferiority. Those Japanese who immigrated to the United States earlier, during the Meiji era, were not brought up with such fanaticism, and Japanese-American writings critical of emperor worship or ultranationalism were often banned in Japan. By the Taisho era, 1912 to 1926, this nationalistic and racist arrogance and fanaticism were well underway in Japan. It was the immigrants of this era who settled in Brazil, carrying with them ideas that led to the tragicomic denouement of their preparing to welcome victorious Japanese troops at the end of World War II, while Japan itself lay prostrate and hungry amid the rubble. The consuming desire to prove something to themselves and to the world has been reflected in many aspects of modern Japanese history, especially the scope and nature of its wars and conquests. A Japanese editorial response to Japan's victory over China in 1895 saw it as demonstrating not only the military power of Japan as a nation, but also that the Japanese people are not inferior to any race in the world, and declared, "We can hardly bear the happiness in our heart." Victory over Russia in 1905, the first time a modern Asian nation had defeated a European nation, produced similar responses. Japan's conquests of the 1930s and early 1940s were marked by a special ruthlessness, murderous cruelty, and pointless humiliations of the conquered peoples, all characteristic of people trying to prove something. The Japanese were noted for their wholesale rapes of the women in conquered countries, their slapping the faces of men on the streets for no reason, and for brutal tortures, mutilations, and executions of captured soldiers and civilians alike. The infamous Bataan Death March, where several thousand captured American and Filipino soldiers were brutally and often sadistically killed, was part of this general pattern. Post-war Japan has been one of the economic miracles of history, emerging not simply as an imitator of Western technology, but as a pioneer in its development and application. The social and political miracle has been no less profound. An historically militaristic society becoming one of the most pacifist, and a nation of autocratic despotism becoming one of the leading democracies of the world. Much of this was the work of just one man, General Douglas MacArthur, who politically maneuvered his way to become the de facto ruler of post-war Japan and the shaper of its institutions and even its psyche. While MacArthur was implacable in his retribution against generals and top politicians responsible for Japan's war atrocities, He was equally rigid in his insistence that American troops repeat none of such behavior in their occupation of Japan. For one of the few times in history, a conquering army was ordered to live only on its own rations, and neither to take nor buy food needed by the hungry conquered people. MacArthur became a national hero to the Japanese for his shrewdly displayed kindness, generosity, and democratic actions. A new pro-Americanism was rekindled in Japan, among a people whose wartime government had led them to expect a nightmare of horrors if Americans conquered their land. Some of the prominent and enduring traits of the Japanese people seem to reflect the peculiar circumstances of their environment and history. Their enormous capacity for sustained and meticulous work is readily understandable in a people whose food has had to be produced from relatively small amounts of not very fertile land, intensely cultivated and irrigated. The large irrigation systems on which their survival depended required much cooperation among people in a given area and subordination of individual interests and idiosyncrasies to the common good. Their meager produce and thin margin of subsistence required an ability to live on little and put aside reserves for contingencies. The natural disasters to which Japan was particularly subject, earthquakes, typhoons, and volcanic eruptions, were reflected in a stoicism and tenacity that have marked the Japanese facing adversities of many kinds, from war to hostile peoples in other lands. Japan's rise to become one of the leading industrial nations of the world by the second half of the 20th century need not obscure the technological backwardness from which this rise began in the 19th century. Trains were unknown to the Japanese when Commodore Perry presented one as a present to an awestruck group of Japanese dignitaries. Yet, a century later, Japan's trains outstripped anything produced in the United States. Large ocean-going ships had not been built in Japan during the long era when foreign travel was forbidden, and the first steel ship was built in Japan in the 1890s, with the quality of Japanese workmanship being inferior to that of European and American producers. But by 1960, Japan was the world's leading shipbuilder, and by 1969, it was producing half the world's tonnage. A similarly dramatic rise of Japanese products took place in the automobile industry. Although the United States produced more than 10 times the number of passenger cars produced in Japan as late as 1965, by 1983, Japanese production exceeded American production, and by 1990, Japan's output of passenger cars was more than 50% higher than that of the United States. In photography, it was much the same story. As of 1990, the United States imported more than 10 times as much photographic products from Japan as from any other country. Yet the road to these pinnacles was far from smooth, and generations of painful efforts were behind these achievements. Japan was a predominantly agricultural nation when it emerged from its isolation from the rest of the world in the mid-19th century, and it remained so on into the 20th century. As of 1881, raw silk and tea accounted for more than half the value of Japanese exports, but by 1910, manufactured goods accounted for more than two-thirds of Japan's exports. Still, in terms of people, as late as 1920, more than half the working population of the country worked in agriculture. The passing years, however, saw the transition of the Japanese economy into a more industrial one, first in light industry, such as the production of textiles, bicycles, and other consumer goods, and later into such heavy industry as iron and steel, chemicals, and shipbuilding. Moreover, increased industrial output was accompanied by improvements in the quality of Japanese work, which had been considered below the standards of established industrial nations. Although Japanese industry was largely devastated by American bombing during World War II, making agriculture again the mainstay of the economy during the period of post-war reconstruction, Japan soon resumed its role as an industrial nation and went on to become one of the leading industrial and technological powers of the world. By then, however, large-scale emigration from Japan had come to an end. Most of the emigrants who settled permanently around the world in countries outside the short-lived Japanese Empire came from an agricultural Japan and carried with them predominantly agricultural skills. However, in addition to specific skills, they took with them the discipline and capacity for hard work, which brought Japan itself to the economic forefront. Japan also had a long tradition of entrepreneurship, so that its historic industrial development was not a product of foreign entrepreneurs, as in so many other countries. This economic initiative also became apparent in the histories of Japanese emigrants who settled overseas. The Western Hemisphere. Although isolated instances of individual Japanese living in the Western Hemisphere are recorded as far back as the early 17th century, substantial numbers of immigrants moved from Japan to the New World only in the late 19th century. Hawaii was the first recipient of substantial Japanese emigration, and for many decades remained one of their principal destinations. Japanese immigration to Hawaii began in 1868, before the government of Japan authorized emigration, and before Hawaii became an American territory. It was one of the few unauthorized, though well-organized, emigrations from Japan. More than 100 contract laborers for the Hawaiian plantations were shipped out of Yokohama without the permission of the newly installed Meiji government. The arrangements proved unsatisfactory to everyone. The laborers, recruited in the city of Yokohama, were not familiar with farm work and turned out to be inadequate for their tasks on the plantations. At the same time, brutal plantation discipline provoked complaints to the Japanese government, which sent an investigator in 1869. As a result, more than one-fourth of the workers were released from their contracts and returned to Japan at the expense of the Hawaiian government. Perhaps as a result of this unhappy experience, the government of Japan took an active role in subsequent Japanese emigration, not merely regulating it, but also promoting and subsidizing it, as well as monitoring the progress of its nationals in other countries. After World War II, nearly 6 million Japanese were sent back to Japan from lands in Asia which Japan had conquered, leaving the Western Hemisphere once more as the home of most Japanese living outside their homeland. As of the middle of the 20th century, more than 90% of all Japanese living in the Western Hemisphere were in just two countries, Brazil and the United States. Altogether, there were about 750,000 Japanese in the Americas, of whom about 373,000 lived in Brazil and 326,000 in the United States. These numbers have continued to grow, but the proportions have remained similar. By 1970, for example, there were nearly 500,000 Japanese in the United States and more than 650,000 in Brazil, followed by more than 50,000 in Peru and more than 30,000 in Canada. However, only 10 Western Hemisphere nations had as many as 1,000 Japanese. The Japanese in Latin America generally have had incomes much higher than those of the general populace in the respective countries in which they lived. So have the Japanese in the United States and Canada. Many continued to send money to Japan long after they settled abroad. Nearly $500,000 a year from Brazil in 1967, upwards of $750,000 from Canada, and more than $25 million from the United States. The first major emigration from modern Japan began in 1885, when the Japanese government negotiated an agreement for agricultural laborers to go to Hawaii as contract workers, whose expenses were paid by their employers. The Japanese who went to the United States paid their own way. The other major destinations of Japanese emigrants in the 19th century were Canada, Australia, Mexico, and Peru, in order of the numbers admitted. The Japanese government subsidized emigration to Latin America, and even helped organize some emigrant colonies in Paraguay and Brazil. But foreign governments later began introducing immigration restrictions against the Japanese, the United States, Mexico, Canada, and South Africa in the early years of the 20th century, followed in 1934 and 1936 by Brazil and Peru. The experiences of the Japanese in the various countries of the Western Hemisphere differed considerably, partly reflecting the terms and conditions under which they immigrated. The Japanese immigration to the Western Hemisphere was largely male before the Japanese government gave direct financial subsidies, which enabled women to emigrate. In Mexico and Bolivia, most Japanese men married local women, but in Brazil, where there were almost as many Japanese women as men, intermarriage was virtually unheard of. In Chile, most Japanese owned shops in the capital city, Santiago, and in Peru, most Japanese quickly became urbanized shopkeepers as well. But in Brazil, most Japanese have been agricultural workers and farmers. Few Japanese have immigrated to the countries of northern South America, Venezuela, Colombia, and Ecuador, and there were fewer than 2,000 Japanese in all of Central America, from which they were expelled during World War II and sent to the United States for internment. Most of the Japanese in Bolivia did not come from Japan, but re-emigrated from Peru. Japanese colonies established in northeastern Argentina after World War II were among many foreign settlements there that pioneered in opening up that undeveloped region. The Japanese were among the most successful. Similarly, in post-war Bolivia, unsuccessful attempts to develop a frontier area with native Bolivians led to the establishment of agricultural colonies of foreign settlers, including people from Japan. Here, too, Japanese success was economically outstanding, whether in terms of output per acre or output per worker. From the beginning of major Japanese emigration in 1885 through 1963, nearly one-third of all Japanese emigrants in the world migrated either to the mainland of the United States or to Hawaii, another 22% to Brazil, 3% each to Canada and Peru, and 3% to all the rest of Latin America combined. Less than one-tenth went to Asia, except for Manchuria, which received one-fourth of all Japanese emigrants during this period, all of whom were later forced to return to Japan after the Second World War. However, few Japanese who migrated to the Western Hemisphere returned to Japan, and in the post-war era, substantial immigration resumed to Brazil and the United States. The Japanese government again subsidized many emigrants, most of whom went to Brazil, while most of the self-financed emigrants went to the United States. As of 1968, half of all Japanese living outside Japan lived in Brazil. The United States. Hawaii was not only the first recipient of modern Japanese emigrants, but also resumed its role as one of the major destinations of emigrants from Japan some years after that initial ill-fated episode. A coincidence of economic conditions in Hawaii and Japan contributed to this result. The Hawaiian sugar industry began booming in the 1870s and 1880s, at the same time when Japan's painful transition to a modern economy was producing large-scale unemployment, bankruptcies, and civil disorders. From 1885 to 1894, more than 28,000 Japanese migrated to Hawaii, the vast majority being single men. Unlike the first Japanese from Yokohama, these Japanese were farmers and farm laborers. They were sojourners rather than settlers. Initially, about three-quarters of them returned to Japan, though with the passing years this figure declined to only one-quarter. Anticipating the application of American laws against contract labor to Hawaii in 1900, after the American takeover of the islands, Hawaiian plantation owners imported more than 26,000 contract laborers from Japan in 1899 in order to beat the ban, the largest number ever admitted in a single year. These contracts were then voided under American laws, however, leaving thousands of Japanese free to migrate to the U.S. mainland. But Hawaii remained the principal area of concentration for Japanese in the United States for many years. As late as 1910, there were about four times as many Japanese in Hawaii as on the mainland. Among other factors, race relations were better in Hawaii. The difference was sufficiently significant for the government of Japan to cease issuing passports for Japanese to go to the U.S. mainland while continuing to authorize passports for Hawaii. While ineffective as a means of controlling ultimate destinations, this policy at least demonstrated that differences in the treatment of Japanese had become known back in Japan. A small but significant group of native-born people of Japanese ancestry arose in 19th-century Hawaii, at a time when such people were virtually non-existent on the mainland. By 1910, the native-born were about one-third as numerous as the foreign-born among the Japanese in Hawaii, while remaining less than 7% on the mainland. By 1930, native-born Japanese Americans exceeded those born in Japan by 80% in Hawaii, while on the mainland, the number of native-born had not quite caught up to those born in Japan. The regional distribution of Japanese also changed over the years, as their numbers grew. At the turn of the century, there were 85,000 Japanese in the United States, nearly two-thirds in Hawaii. By 1920, there were more than 220,000 Japanese, just over half living on the mainland. Both on the mainland and in Hawaii, Japanese relations with the larger society were to some extent shaped by the fact that they followed in the wake of the Chinese. In both places, the Chinese had begun as unskilled laborers, and many had worked their way up to become small businessmen, and were hated for their advancement and their competition. The Japanese were initially welcomed as substitutes for the Chinese as coolie labor, but then they too became increasingly resented as they advanced to small farming and small business enterprise. Soon they were lumped together with the Chinese as the Yellow Peril, threatening the living standards of American workers, businessmen, and American society in general. This reaction was more pronounced on the mainland than in Hawaii, but it was present in both places. Laws were passed in Hawaii to block the movement of the Japanese into skilled occupations, and on the mainland to stop their purchase of land in California. Despite discriminatory laws and practices, the Japanese continued to advance economically. Among first-generation Japanese-American family heads living on the mainland, a majority began either as farm laborers or as domestic servants, with less than 4% owning or managing farms and less than 4% owning or managing businesses. But 3/5 of this generation of Japanese men eventually became owners or managers of either farms or businesses before World War II. The largest number became farmers, and more than 2/3 of these could speak only broken English or no English at all. They also had to overcome the handicap of alien land laws, which made it illegal for aliens ineligible for citizenship, Asians, to own land in California, where most mainland Japanese lived. Similar laws were passed in other states. A variety of evasions developed, followed by a tightening of the legal loopholes, followed by more evasions. However, time was on the side of the Japanese, as their American-born children were automatically citizens of the United States, to whom the land laws could not apply under the U.S. Constitution. In the decade of the 1930s, the land owned by Japanese Americans in California more than doubled. A majority of employed Japanese males still worked in farming as late as 1940, and they produced about 1/3 of the commercial truck farming crops sold in California. The Japanese gained their initial foothold in agriculture by working as agricultural laborers for lower wages than whites, and then acquired farms by paying more than whites for the land. Once established, they became formidable competitors. Where agricultural laborers were paid by piece rate, as about half were, the Japanese earned substantially more than whites through greater diligence and longer hours. As their reputation as hard workers spread, their hourly pay rose and eventually overtook that of whites. Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, set the stage for a traumatic landmark in the history of Japanese Americans. In the shock and anger that followed this treacherous attack, which occurred in the midst of negotiations ostensibly aimed at peace, anti-Japanese feelings ran high, especially on the mainland. In Hawaii, where the attack occurred, killing many Japanese Americans, among others, fewer than 1,500 Japanese Americans were taken into custody as enemy aliens, but on the mainland, more than 100,000 were interned. The economic impact was as devastating as the social trauma. Businesses built up over many years had to be liquidated in a matter of weeks at ruinous losses, nor could shattered careers be readily resumed after the war. The wartime internment had lasting economic after-effects, reflected in occupational declines among Japanese Americans after the war. The proportion of first-generation Japanese Americans on the mainland who owned their own businesses or farms in the post-war years was only about half what it had been in the pre-war years. The proportion of this generation who became house servants more than doubled the pre-war level. Those who became farm laborers in the post-war years were more than triple the pre-war percentage. The number who were professionals also declined. But while these disastrous economic retrogressions struck the first generation Japanese Americans, Issei, the second generation, Nisei, forged ahead at an accelerated rate. American citizens, American educated, with more years of schooling than whites, the Nisei sought lucrative professions. In colleges and universities, they seldom majored in liberal arts. By 1959, Japanese Americans as a group had reached the family income of whites, and by 1969, they exceeded the national average in family income by 32%. This trend has continued, with the 1990 census showing the median family income of Japanese Americans to be 45% higher than the median family income of native-born non-Asian Americans. Along with this economic progress came acculturation and social acceptance, including rising rates of intermarriage. By 1980, three-quarters of all Japanese Americans spoke only English. Ironically, the Japanese on the mainland, who historically faced more discrimination as well as wartime internment, achieved higher incomes and occupational levels than those in Hawaii. The Japanese in Hawaii were also much more active politically, and by 1971 had a majority in the state legislature. Yet these political advantages of the Japanese in Hawaii, together with the advantage of not having been subjected to the massive internments on the mainland, were still not enough to overcome other advantages of the Japanese on the mainland. Historically, the Japanese who immigrated to Hawaii came from poorer regions and poorer classes in Japan than did those who went to the U.S. mainland. Apparently, this social difference had enduring economic consequences, more so than differences in their treatment by the larger society or differences in the political clout of Japanese Americans in Hawaii versus the mainland. Canada. The first documented Japanese immigration to Canada occurred in 1877, but the numbers have never been large as a percentage of the total Canadian population. By 1979, there were nearly 50,000 Japanese in Canada, but they were less than 0.5% of the Canadian population. However, the Japanese immigrants were not evenly spread across Canada, but were initially concentrated in the western province of British Columbia. At the time of Pearl Harbor, more than three-quarters of all the Japanese in Canada lived within a 75-mile radius of the city of Vancouver. As with other immigrant concentrations in various countries, this reflected ties with specific individuals, as well as a general desire to settle among compatriots. About half the pre-war Japanese immigrants had relatives or friends in British Columbia. Yet, even in pre-war British Columbia, the Chinese and Japanese put together were still outnumbered more than 10-1 by whites. Japanese immigration to Canada began very small, but grew rapidly. As of 1896, there were fewer than 1,000 Japanese in Canada, mostly fishermen on the Pacific coast of British Columbia, but increasing numbers came from Japan over the years to take jobs in such locally expanding Canadian industries as fishing, lumbering, mining, and railroad construction. By 1901, there were more than 4,700 Japanese in Canada, 97% of them in British Columbia. Perhaps as a result of Japan's mobilization for war with Russia, very few Japanese immigrants arrived in the first few years of the 20th century. Canada received only about 2% of all emigrants from Japan during the entire 1885 to 1907 period, compared to nearly half who went either to the U.S. mainland or to such American possessions as Hawaii and the Philippines. At the end of the Russo-Japanese War, Japanese immigration to Canada resumed, and on a larger scale. In less than 3 years, another 7,000 Japanese arrived in Canada. Partly this reflected the newly enacted American restrictions on Japanese settling on the U.S. mainland from Hawaii. The rapidly increasing numbers of the Japanese, and their geographic and occupational concentrations, caused them to be seen as a serious competitive threat, despite their relatively modest numbers on a national scale. Moreover, almost all of the Japanese immigrants were young single men, so that their proportion of the visible workforce was much higher than their proportion in the general population, which of course included women and children. The Japanese also worked harder and for lower pay than whites, displacing them in many cases, and thereby becoming one of the most hated groups in the province. As early as 1901, the Japanese constituted 22% of the workforce in the 7 largest mills in the Vancouver area. Canadian labor unions organized the first anti-Japanese rally in Canada in August 1907. Weeks of anti-Japanese agitation in Vancouver culminated in a riot in which a mob of whites attacked the city's Chinese and Japanese neighborhoods. the mob rampaged through the Chinatown area but were turned back by the determined resistance of the Japanese. This crisis led to an international gentlemen's agreement between Canada and Japan, the net result of which was a restriction of Japanese immigration to Canada. Again, as in the American situation, the Japanese government's demonstrated strength during the war with Russia gave it the prestige and leverage to salvage some concessions for their people overseas. Unlike the overwhelmingly male Chinese community in Canada, the Japanese young men were not left stranded without women when Asian immigration was curbed. As in the United States, wives could be brought from Japan to Canada, including the picture brides selected for them by their families overseas. After the so-called gentleman's agreement, more females than males immigrated from Japan to Canada. Over the years, the initially larger Chinese population of Canada declined as the Chinese men died off or returned to China without being replaced by children. The Japanese community, however, continued to grow rapidly, composed as it was of young couples in the prime childbearing years. Their birth rate was more than double that of British Columbia as a whole. However, this rapid increase moderated as the young Japanese population grew older. In the early years, the Japanese immigrants were concentrated in half a dozen laboring occupations, but by the 1930s, they were represented in almost every occupation or sub-occupation listed by the Canadian census. This occurred in the face of determined attempts by whites to prevent it. As early as 1902, a royal commission reported that the Japanese, living in shacks along the water, were able to undersell whites in boat building. Employers, especially in the canneries, preferred the Japanese both as laborers and as fishermen because of their skills and work habits. By 1921, the Japanese held more than 40% of the fishing licenses in the province, more than either whites or Aboriginal Indians. In the sawmills, Japanese workers competed so well by working for less that at least one mill refused to hire whites. The Japanese even undercut the wages of Chinese workers who had arrived earlier in Canada and had become established in this industry. The political counterattack against the Japanese began early in the fishing industry, where they were especially successful. In 1920, the Vancouver authorities began reducing the number of licenses issued to the Japanese. After several years of continuing reductions, the Japanese appealed to the courts, and in 1928, the Canadian Supreme Court ruled that the government could not discriminate in this way. But the years that passed before this decision saw a decline in Japanese fishermen, and the status quo ante was not restored. In 1933, the Japanese held 28% fewer fishing licenses than in 1922, while whites and Indians each doubled their previous shares. In the lumbering industry, a different approach was used against the Japanese. Here, the Japanese immigrants were typically very low-paid workers, so a minimum wage law was used for the explicit purpose of pricing them out of jobs. This minimum wage law was passed in British Columbia in 1925, when 45% of the lumbering workers were Orientals. A year later, more than 1,000 white workers had been added and more than 400 Orientals eliminated. Like the displaced Japanese in the fishing industry, some of these workers returned to Japan. In a number of occupations, government regulation, contracts, or franchises permitted local politicians to impose restrictions or prohibitions on the hiring of Japanese. Even where these efforts were subsequently overruled by higher national authorities, this took time, and the Japanese were excluded until the legal processes ran their course. Subcontractors for the Provincial Department of Public Works, for example, were explicitly forbidden to hire Asians, directly or indirectly, upon, about, or in connection with the works. Discrimination against the Japanese as employees led many into self-employment, notably in agriculture, but also in urban small businesses as well. Among berry growers in British Columbia, Asians held 29% of the acreage in 1920, rising to 45% by 1934. Because the Japanese cultivated much more intensively than the whites, their share of all the berries grown in the province was even larger than their share of the land and reached an estimated 85% in 1934. Urban Japanese likewise sought self-employment. As of 1931, 20% of the barber's licenses granted in Vancouver went to the Japanese, as did nearly half the licenses for fish dealers and more than half the licenses as dressmakers. By the mid-1930s, there were about 860 businesses run by the Japanese in Vancouver. Just over half the Japanese working in that city remained laborers at this point, however. With the rise of the Japanese into the business class, the organized political opposition to them also rose from the working class to the businessmen. Whereas there was little anti-Japanese activity or feeling among white businessmen in British Columbia in 1913, by 1919, the British Columbia Retail Merchants Association had organized a massive anti-Japanese letter-writing campaign directed at elected officials. They also tried to get stricter enforcement of retail store closing laws, charging that the Japanese were gaining customers by staying open longer, or even by making sales on Sunday. These efforts largely failed in the long run. From 1927 to 1937, the number of Japanese candy and fruit merchants in Vancouver increased from 58 to 80, and the number of grocers from 56 to 110. By 1937, the Japanese held 20% of all grocers' licenses in Vancouver and 91% of all greengrocers' licenses. In the more strictly government-controlled occupations, civil service, logging on government land, or government-licensed professions such as law, pharmacy, and dentistry, the Japanese were much more effectively kept out. There were only 3 Japanese listed as working in public administration and defense combined in 1931. The first generation of Japanese immigrants in Canada spoke little English. As late as 1925, only about 1/4 of them declared that they could read and speak English. The second generation, the Nisei, learned English in school and Japanese at home, but often did not learn either language well enough to be fluent and comfortable in it. They were, however, noted for being well-behaved children in school, and their rate of juvenile delinquency was well below the national average. The Japanese acculturated in superficial aspects, such as clothing and furnishings, but retained their own sense of values and patterns of behavior. For example, they took care of their own needy rather than leave them to public charity. Even during the Great Depression of the 1930s, only 4% of the Japanese in Canada received public relief, compared to 13% of the general population. World War II proved to be an even bigger disaster for the Japanese in Canada than in the United States. More than 1,000 Japanese-owned fishing vessels were impounded. Japanese-language newspapers were closed. Then Japanese employees began to be fired, and political pressure groups in British Columbia began to demand that the Japanese be interned. Neither the Canadian military authorities nor the Royal Canadian Mounted Police saw any danger from the Japanese in Canada, and in fact, none of them was ever convicted of any espionage or sabotage during the war. Nevertheless, the political pressures from British Columbia caused the central government to give in to their demands. Already regarded as security risks before Pearl Harbor, and registered and required to have papers on them at all times in Canada, the Japanese Canadians were now rounded up and interned. By this time, 60% of all Japanese in Canada were native-born. 3/4 of those removed from the west coast of Canada were either Canadian-born citizens or naturalized citizens. As in the United States, a sudden internment meant hasty sales of businesses and homes that represented a lifetime of work and savings. They typically sold for less than 1/4 their value. Most of the Japanese-owned businesses were bought by members of other middleman minorities, Chinese, Greeks, and Jews. As in the United States, the Japanese were interned in remote places. Most spent the war in shacks hastily assembled in Canadian ghost towns under the control of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. But the Japanese in Canada were interned earlier and kept interned longer than Japanese in the United States. Moreover, when they were released, they were not allowed to return home like Japanese Americans. British Columbia did not want them back, and they were not allowed to settle on the West Coast until 1949. The Canadian government presented them with the choice of relocating east of the Rocky Mountains or going to Japan. More than 40% of the Japanese said that they would rather go to war-devastated Japan than remain in Canada. However, early reports from those who did in fact relocate to Japan depicted so many hardships there that many of those who had asked to go decided to relocate to eastern Canada instead. The post-war economic recovery of the Japanese in Canada has been at least as spectacular as that in the United States. The younger generation encountered less discrimination when scattered across parts of Canada with no history of organized anti-Japanese activity. While less than 1% of Japanese Canadians were in professional occupations in 1935, by 1971, more than one-third of the Nisei in Toronto were professionals. Japanese Canadians as a whole earned 16% higher income than the Canadian national average. The average family income of the second generation Japanese in Toronto was nearly twice the Canadian national average. The Japanese were not only more dispersed nationally, with Toronto now superseding Vancouver as the main concentration, but were also so widely dispersed within the city that it was rare to find two Japanese living in the same block. More than half the marriages of the third generation were intermarriages, compared to just 1% in 1941. Yet, the Japanese rose economically and were eventually accepted socially without ever having held a major elective office in Canada. As in other countries and with other groups, political power has had little correlation with the economic success of Japanese in the Western Hemisphere. Peru. In 1873, Peru became the first Latin American nation to establish diplomatic relations with Japan. However, this grew out of isolated and bizarre international shipping incidents and led neither to important ties between the two countries nor to immigration. The first Japanese vessel did not call at a Peruvian port until 1883, and the first significant numbers of Japanese immigrants did not arrive until 15 years later. As in Canada and the United States, the Japanese arrived in Peru in the wake of the Chinese, and were often lumped together with them in popular perception, especially in the early years. Nearly 100,000 Chinese had immigrated to Peru between 1849 and 1874 and had aroused public animosity, expressed in riots and massacres, because of their economic competition as agricultural laborers and as small businessmen. The Japanese who arrived in 1898 were overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly agricultural laborers, but within a year of their arrival, most had moved to the cities. This represented the first of many mutual disappointments between Japanese agricultural laborers and Peruvian landowners. Around the turn of the century, Japanese workers were imported under indenture contracts, which required them to work to pay off the cost of transporting them across the Pacific. Language and cultural differences, as well as unscrupulous employers and sometimes bungling immigration companies, led to many frictions and defections. The death rate among the young Japanese men was remarkably high. Among the first wave of 790 Japanese, there were 143 deaths the first year from a variety of diseases. Of the 984 Japanese who arrived in 1903 and 1904, nearly half died in the sugarcane fields. Japanese annual immigration to Peru went over 1,000 for the first time in 1908, when it reached 2,442. A level never reached again in a single year. However, there were a number of years around World War I when Japanese immigration exceeded 1,000 annually, as it did again during the mid to late 1920s. After that, however, Japanese immigration to Peru was measured in the hundreds. Since 1950, immigration to Peru from Japan has been fewer than 100 annually, except for 2 years, and has been zero for 3 years. Departures were also high, exceeding 1,000 in 1935. From the mid to late 1930s, the number of Japanese leaving Peru exceeded the number entering. Natural increase, however, led to a growing population of Japanese in the country. The number of Japanese living in Peru was more than 20,000 in 1930, and this grew to more than 50,000 by 1970. Despite the relatively small size of the Japanese community in Peru, it had by 1930 become the most prominent foreign element in a country that received relatively little immigration. Their economic presence was especially notable as they moved from agricultural labor to urban occupations as artisans and small businessmen. Even as agricultural laborers, the Japanese were resented, for their work habits caused them to be sufficiently in demand to be paid more than Peruvian workers. Many of the Japanese moved from agricultural labor to jobs as urban domestic servants, a role which, among other things, aided their learning the Spanish language. Others became small shopkeepers, factory workers, or took miscellaneous other jobs that allowed them to move slowly but steadily up the economic ladder. Although most Japanese came to Peru as agricultural workers, most soon found their way to the capital city of Lima and its environs. As of 1909, there were 441 Japanese factory workers in the vicinity of Lima, along with 257 domestics and cooks, 35 carpenters, and 59 small merchants and peddlers. The number of Japanese-owned barber shops in Lima rose from 1 in 1904 to 130 20 years later, nearly three-quarters of all barber shops in the city in 1924. A Japanese Chamber of Commerce was formed in Lima in 1915 with 27 members. 4 years later, it had more than 100 members. The number of Japanese grocery stores increased from 28 to about 200. Often the Japanese bought out Italian or Chinese shopkeepers. The Peruvian press attacked the growing range and competitive success of Japanese businesses. Attempts to promote boycotts of these businesses proved ineffective, however, for the Japanese typically charged lower prices. Partly these reflected smaller profit margins and partly lower overhead costs, as the Japanese small businessman and or his clerks often lived on the premises. Unlike their Hispanic competitors, even prosperous Japanese businessmen seldom lived ostentatiously. As in Canada, the Japanese reputation for fulfilling business obligations was high, leading to high credit ratings. The Japanese also took more interest in educating their children than did other Peruvians, building a foundation for their continued advancement. In the city, as in the countryside, Japanese workers acquired a reputation for being more painstaking and conscientious than Peruvian workers. The Japanese thus became prominent among skilled workers and came to own nearly one-fourth of the mechanical and watch repair shops in Lima. They created the tire repair trade in Peru and dominated it for years. While economic boycotts against the Japanese did not prove to be viable, political action did. A law was passed requiring at least 80% of all employees to be Peruvians. Immigration from Japan was severely restricted in the mid-1930s. In May 1940, a Peruvian mob attack on the Japanese and their property in the cities of Lima and Callao also expressed a rising anti-Japanese feeling. The coming of World War II heightened anti-Japanese feelings and policies in Peru. More than 1,700 Japanese were identified as potentially dangerous enemy aliens with the aid of the American FBI and were shipped to the United States for wartime internment. Peru was only one of a number of Latin American nations to ship parts of their own Japanese population to the United States. There was some thought that they might be exchanged for U.S. citizens held by Japan. But Peru participated in this operation with a vengeance, sending more than four-fifths of all the Japanese from Latin America who were interned in the USA. Hundreds were later shipped to Japan from the United States during the war on a neutral ship, and hundreds more were sent to Japan after the war. Peru permitted only 79 to return. However, 90% of the Japanese in Peru were not interned. They were simply subjected to many restrictions. Nor was there a mass exodus of Japanese after the war. As of 1970, Peru had a larger Japanese population than Canada and was exceeded in this respect only by Brazil and the United States. The prosperity of the Japanese in post-war Peru was more striking than anywhere else in Latin America except Brazil. Historic popular resentment and political discrimination proved to be incapable of stopping their rise. Moreover, the history of Japanese economic success in Peru has also been a history of Japanese contributions to the Peruvian economy. These include contributions in agriculture, where the Japanese produced 25% of the cotton crop in the late 1930s, to the urban commercial sector, where they introduced modern merchandising methods, more ethical business practices, and greater cleanliness in food processing. As in other countries, The Japanese in Peru acquired a reputation for hard work, reliability, and honesty, while anti-Japanese snobbishness persisted on into the 1990s in some exclusive upper-class social clubs. The general society increasingly accepted them. One sign of that greater social acceptance was that a little-known businessman of Japanese ancestry was elected president in 1990, defeating a world-famous Hispanic Peruvian writer. In 1995, he was re-elected in a landslide, defeating another famous Hispanic Peruvian who had been Secretary General of the United Nations. As in the United States, however, this political success followed economic success and was neither a cause nor even a contributing factor. Brazil. Significant emigration from Japan to Brazil began early in the 20th century and was accelerated by the immigration restrictions of the United States and by the curtailment of European immigration to Brazil resulting from World War I. Fewer than 1,000 Japanese arrived annually in Brazil as late as 1910, but in 1913, nearly 7,000 arrived. By 1930, Japanese immigration to Brazil approached 14,000 annually, and there were more than 116,000 Japanese living in Brazil, 78% of all Japanese in Latin America. The inflow from Japan around that time outnumbered the German and Italian inflows to Brazil combined, and was second only to the Portuguese immigration. Most Japanese settled in the state of São Paulo, in southern Brazil. 223 out of 234 heads of families during the years 1908 to 1912, and 6,129 out of 6,518 family heads during the years 1933 to 1937, with comparably lopsided proportions in between. Their origins were also not random. Prior to 1930, 60% of the immigrants from Japan came from just 5 of the country's 47 prefects, though greater diversity of origins appeared among later immigrants. Their destinations, however, remained very similar throughout the pre-war era. As late as 1940, 90% of the Japanese immigrants in Brazil still lived in the state of São Paulo. However, even in this state, the 200,000 to 250,000 Japanese were less than 3% of the population. Return migration to Japan throughout the pre-war era has been estimated at about 15,000 people. The peak of Japanese immigration to Brazil was reached in 1933, when more than 24,000 arrived, more than half of all immigrants to Brazil that year. At that point, more than one-fifth of all Japanese living outside Japan lived in Brazil. But after 1934, when immigration restrictions were applied, the decline of Japanese immigration to Brazil was sharp, in both absolute and relative terms. By 1941, there were only about 1,500 immigrants arriving from Japan, and they were less than 6% of all immigrants to Brazil at that time. After World War II, there was some resumption of Japanese immigration to Brazil at somewhat more than the immediate pre-war level, but not approaching the immigration in the peak years of the early 1930s. Most of the new post-war immigrants settled in the Amazon region of the Northeast, rather than in the southern region where most Japanese were concentrated. Altogether, about 250,000 Japanese immigrated to Brazil over the period from 1908 to 1975. After taking into account return migration and natural increase, there was a net Japanese population of 750,000 living in Brazil at the latter date, 75% of whom lived in the state of São Paulo. The first Japanese immigrants to Brazil came as a group in 1908. As a result of a contract between the state of São Paulo and a private emigration corporation in Japan. As in Hawaii, this initial effort failed amid bitter recriminations, apparently due to lack of knowledge of local conditions, and the company went bankrupt. But Japanese immigration continued, with sharp fluctuations, but generally increasing from the hundreds initially entering annually to the thousands immigrating annually around World War I. As of 1918, the approximately 5,600 Japanese immigrants were more than one-fourth of all immigrants to Brazil. Japanese immigration to Brazil remained primarily an organized corporate undertaking rather than a matter of isolated immigrants crossing the Pacific. Japanese immigrants came in groups and lived together as groups in Brazil, in all Japanese agricultural communities, sealed off from the rest of Brazilian society. This was the choice of the Japanese organizers rather than of the Brazilian authorities or populace. The purpose was to minimize frictions with the Brazilian population and forestall the kind of popular hostility that had led to the exclusion of the Japanese from other countries. Many immigrants who began as agricultural laborers in the Japanese colonies went on to become small independent farmers, but still living within the Japanese enclaves. More than 90% of the Japanese heads of families arriving in Brazil in the pre-war era were farmers, but more than three-quarters of them began working in Brazil as contract laborers in agriculture, though very few remained in that position very long. Nearly half left that status within 2 years, and more than two-thirds within 4 years, with fewer than 1% remaining contract laborers permanently. Unlike other predominantly agricultural peoples in some other lands, the Japanese in Brazil were educated. During the entire period from the early 20th century until 1941, Japanese immigrants to Brazil had higher literacy rates, 74%, than those of Italian immigrants, 60%, and much higher literacy rates than Portuguese, 43%, Turkish, 38%, or Spanish immigrants, 28%. The Japanese literacy rate was exceeded only by that of Polish, 77%, and German immigrants, 87%, to Brazil. The Japanese colonies contained not only their own leaders, doctors, and social institutions, but also created their own rice mills, lumber mills, a sugar factory, and electric generating capacity. They also built roads, bridges, waterworks, and radio stations. The Japanese created the silk industry in Brazil, so that Brazil no longer imported silk. The Japanese, who were only 2-3% of the population of the state of Sao Paulo and owned less than 2% of its land, nevertheless produced nearly 30% of its agricultural output in the early 1930s, including 46% of the cotton, 57% of the silk, and 75% of the tea. By 1943, the Japanese owned more than 1 million acres of land in Sao Paulo. A substantial proportion of the banana plantations and fishing were also in Japanese hands. These Japanese colonies were for years run by officials appointed in Tokyo. Moreover, banks in Japan opened offices in Brazil. This policy of establishing self-contained Japanese enclaves largely avoided obvious, direct economic competition between the Japanese and local workers, farmers, or businessmen, competition which had provoked great hostility elsewhere in the hemisphere, especially where the Japanese became a middleman minority, as in Peru. Moreover, the Japanese colonies were almost equally balanced between the sexes, 60% male, so that another source of interaction and competition with the local populace was avoided. More than 90% of all Japanese immigrants to Brazil from 1908 to 1941 came in family groups. The Japanese attempt in Brazil to avoid situations that caused trouble in other countries seemed at first to pay off well. The Japanese were so welcome in Brazil that even a local civil war blockade of the Port of Santos in 1932 was lifted long enough to allow a ship full of Japanese immigrants to enter, the only ship allowed through the blockade during the whole period of military hostilities. A 1933 Brazilian study concluded that the Japanese settler was of great efficiency, hard-working, orderly, economical, obedient, and law-abiding. Yet even in Brazil, those few Japanese who became middlemen, storekeepers and petty traders, met resentment. The fact that most Japanese in Brazil avoided such roles and avoided open competition with Brazilians in general undoubtedly had much to do with their acceptance. From a strictly economic viewpoint, the Japanese in their enclaves were as much in competition with other Brazilians as if they were living completely mingled with them. But politically, the appearances were quite different, with many Brazilians paying little attention to the isolated Japanese, even though purchasing their output through the roundabout channels of commerce. Although socially and culturally isolated, the Japanese in Brazil were not literally sealed off physically from all contact with others. In part of the agricultural Ribeira Valley, located in the southern regions of the state of Sao Paulo, the largely illiterate and barefoot day laborers known as caboclos outnumbered the Japanese by at least 2-1 in the early 1940s, but they lived socially very distinct lives. In the Ribeira Valley town of Registro, 21 of the 25 stores were owned by Japanese, and both the traders and the clerks were largely Japanese. Under these circumstances, intermarriage between the Japanese and Brazilians was not only rare, but was a sign of a loss of social status on the part of the Japanese involved. Despite the social cohesiveness and cultural persistence of the distinctive inner values of the Japanese, many outward cultural changes occurred in the very different geographic, climatic, and economic environment of Brazil. For example, while a peasant on horseback was a rare sight in Japan, this became a common sight among the Japanese farmers in the Ribeira Valley, where distances were greater and the roads were of poorer quality. The construction of houses was also adapted to local conditions, and Western clothes became common. In a deliberate decision made by authorities in Japan, Japanese emigrants were instructed not to create Buddhist or Shinto institutions in Brazil, where in fact they became at least nominal Christians, though with some survivals of their ancestral religious practices continuing privately. The decision that these emigrants should wear Western clothing was also made by authorities in Japan. The need to minimize friction with the local Brazilians was clearly a high priority. Japanese children born in Brazil learned the Portuguese language when they attended the public schools. In the school setting, the use of the Japanese language was an offense to be reported to the teacher. Accordingly, Japanese children in the Ribeira Valley in the early 1940s spoke Portuguese without an accent, even though their parents generally spoke much poorer quality Portuguese. This mastery of the national language of Brazil not only represented an element of acculturation in itself, but opened the door to further acculturation through reading Brazilian newspapers, books, and other publications, and facilitating business or social contacts with other Brazilians. At the same time, when Portuguese became the primary language of the younger generation, this made interactions with their own parents less easy. Often the parents spoke to their children in Japanese, and the children replied in Portuguese. As farmers, the Japanese introduced new crops, new agricultural methods, scientific analysis of soils, and hard work. Their output per acre was more than 4 times that of other immigrant farmers in Brazil, and more than 8 times that of Brazilian farmers. For years, the Japanese prospered in Brazil, while being largely ignored politically. But 2 developments eventually brought them unwelcome political attention: the rise of Japan as an imperialist power in the 1930s, and the rise of nationalism in Brazil at the same time, which cast suspicion and resentment on separatist minorities, including Germans and Italians, as well as Japanese. In 1938, the Brazilian government began a conscious campaign of cultural Brazilianization, requiring, among other things, that the Portuguese language be taught in all schools and shutting down private schools conducted in foreign languages, such as those which often supplemented public school education among the Japanese in Brazil. With Japan being seen increasingly as a military menace and an economic rival, the presence of an enclave in Brazil controlled from Japan aroused serious concern. That concern was expressed first in restrictions on immigration from Japan in 1934, and then in increasing government supervision of the Japanese colonies, especially after Japan's entry into World War II. The Japanese, however, were not so much singled out as they were part of a general concern over unassimilated foreign enclaves in Brazil, particularly when the principal such enclaves were made up of nationals of the 3 countries of the Germany-Italy-Japan Axis powers, who were aggressive, seeking new lands to conquer. In addition to banning foreign political activity in Brazil and passing laws making it easier to deport aliens, the Brazilian government also launched a campaign of Brazilianization in the country's education system, requiring both public and private schools to teach the language of the country, Portuguese, as well as the history and geography of Brazil. A wartime government report on the Japanese colonies still praised their sanitary conditions, but now noted that all books and periodicals in the settlement were in the Japanese language, and that textbooks in Japanese contained propaganda and military instructions. This was in violation of the laws of the Brazilianization campaign, but the Japanese continued to evade these laws by establishing clandestine schools using the Japanese language and promoting Japanese ideals. Although Brazil did not declare war on Japan until June 1945, when the war was almost over, the Japanese in Brazil were put under the same wartime restrictions imposed on Germans and Italians after Brazil declared war on Germany and Italy in 1942. These included restrictions on travel, bans on possession of firearms or explosives, and a suspension of the constitutional rights of Germans, Italians, and Japanese in Brazil. There was press hysteria and brief, apparently token arrests of local Japanese leaders, along with confiscations of radios and firearms. About 1,000 Japanese families were evacuated from the vicinity of the port of Santos. But the measures taken fell far short of those against Japanese in Peru, Canada, the United States, or Central America. Moreover, Brazil did not join other Latin American nations which shipped Japanese to the United States for wartime internment. These national differences in wartime treatment of Japanese minorities reflected pre-war political attitudes toward the Japanese in these countries, rather than differences in military vulnerability or even the loyalty of local Japanese. In Brazil, there was in fact far more pro-Japan sentiment and activity among the Japanese than in other Western Hemisphere nations, where much harsher measures were taken. In Brazil, more than 50,000 Japanese belonged to a pro-Japan organization whose activities included sabotage and terrorism against members of the Japanese community who were considered to be collaborators in the war effort against Japan. The utter isolation of some Japanese communities in Brazil made it possible for pro-Japan fanatics to maintain that Japan had won the war even after its surrender in 1945. 16 Japanese-Brazilian leaders who asserted that Japan had lost the war were assassinated, the last being killed as late as 1947. So convinced were many Japanese of Japan's victory that more than 2,000 of them journeyed to the port of Santos to meet a non-existent Japanese naval force supposedly sent to take them back to their victorious homeland. As with many movements, what began as an ideology ended as a racket, including the sale of land in the Japanese Empire and collections for arranging welcoming events for visiting Japanese officials celebrating their victory over the United States. It was at this point that those Japanese Brazilians who proclaimed Japan's defeat were assassinated. They were now a threat to money, not simply to group morale. Over the years, despite the success of Japanese agricultural colonies, there was a movement of people from the farms to the cities. For example, during the period from 1945 to 1958, the number of Japanese families living in the city of Sao Paulo doubled, and there was some regional dispersion of Japanese as well. By 1958, 45% of the Japanese in Brazil were urban. This was all the more remarkable because post-war Brazilian immigration policy favored agricultural immigration from Japan. However, the movement to the cities was not by any means a completely new phenomenon. More than one-fourth of the original 781 Japanese immigrants to Brazil in 1908 moved on to the cities of Santos and Sao Paulo. Only the continued inflow of Japanese immigrants to the agricultural colonies maintained the rural predominance among Japanese in Brazil. In the post-war era as well, most immigrants from Japan to Brazil went into agriculture and were in fact recruited from the predominantly agricultural island of Kyushu. The changing rural-urban mix of the Japanese population in Brazil has been reflected in the share of Japanese farmers in the agricultural output of the state of Sao Paulo and of Brazil as a whole. From the mid-1930s to the mid-1950s, the growing role of the Japanese farmers was reflected in their rising proportions of the agricultural output of the state of Sao Paulo, where most of them lived. They produced 33% of the state's potatoes in the mid-1930s, and 60% in the mid-1950s. They produced 75% of the tea in the earlier period and 100% in the later period. In the later period, they also produced 90% of the state's eggs and peppermint, 99% of its tomatoes, and 100% of its peaches. However, the post-war urbanization of many second-generation Japanese in Brazil was reflected in declines in the Japanese share of various agricultural crops. Though as late as 1978, they still produced 71% of the tomatoes in the state of Sao Paulo, 80% of the silkworms, 92% of the strawberries, and 94% of the tea. At one time, more than half the tomatoes in the entire country were grown by the Japanese, who were less than 1% of Brazil's population. Education has been an important part of the Japanese success story in Brazil. Even in Sao Paulo, where they have been concentrated, the Japanese were less than 3% of the population in the 1970s, but they were 10% of university enrollment. In Brazil as a whole, the Japanese have had the highest proportion of college graduates of all the ethnic groups. This was achieved despite the rural locations of most Japanese, which often necessitated sending their children away to boarding schools, even for high school education. As of 1988, 16% of the students at the University of Sao Paulo were Japanese, and were often resented by other students as unfair competition because they work so hard. A physics professor at the university said, "In my classes, they are always the brilliant ones, the top 20 students." The economic success of the Japanese in Brazil has been particularly remarkable in view of their relatively recent arrival in the country, virtually all within the 20th century. Moreover, their assimilation into Brazilian society has not been particularly rapid. During the entire period from 1908 to 1947, the intermarriage rate for Japanese females in Brazil never reached 1%, and that of males reached only 4%. As late as 1958, nearly two-thirds of all Japanese in Brazil spoke only the Japanese language, compared to 28% who spoke both Japanese and Portuguese, and only 8% who spoke Portuguese alone. Their intermarriage rate was now 14%, and that represented a considerable rise over the years, intermarriages being only 3% of all existing Japanese marriages. Even their local origins in Japan still affected their marriage patterns in Brazil. In the extreme case, more than 90% of Okinawans who married in Brazil married other Okinawans. Late marriages remained the rule among Japanese in Brazil, as in Japan. In religion, there was some sign of assimilation, but 45% of the Japanese remained Buddhists in an overwhelmingly Catholic country. Some westernized names, usually in combination with Japanese names, were given to the second generation, 42%, but only 8% were given purely westernized names, and about half were given purely Japanese names. By the late 20th century, there were estimated to be close to 1 million Japanese in Brazil, and they owned almost three-fourths as much land in Brazil as there is in Japan. They also prospered in Brazil's urban economy, where they owned banks and produced paper, plastics, fertilizer, and electronics. Japan's post-war re-entry into Brazil's economy, with investments succeeded only by those of the United States and West Germany, created further employment opportunities for Japanese Brazilians who worked by the hundreds for such firms as Sony, Mitsubishi, and Honda. Among the business advantages of the Japanese in Brazil was a reputation for honesty in a country noted for its corruption in both business and politics. Like other groups with a rapid economic rise and a slow assimilation rate, the Japanese in Brazil advanced to a large extent through self-employment. This was a long process, however. As of 1912, only 14% of the Japanese in Brazil were self-employed, but by 1958, 86% had achieved this status. Most were farmers, but among the Japanese in non-agricultural occupations, half were tradesmen. Less than 1% worked for the government. It was the middle of the 20th century before the first Japanese was elected as a representative in the state capital of Sao Paulo. However, by 1988, two Nisei had served as cabinet members and three as members of Congress. As elsewhere, their political success followed in the wake of economic success, rather than being a factor in producing that success. Implications. The rise of the Japanese in country after country, from their initial role as low-paid, unskilled laborers to middle-class occupations in the second and later generations, has implications which reach well beyond the remarkable history of this remarkable group of immigrants. The methods and nature of their rise challenge widely held beliefs as to the historical causes or contemporary prospects for advancing poorer racial or ethnic minorities. Neither political activities nor biological assimilation played significant roles in the rise of the Japanese, though both political success and substantial racial intermarriage occurred after their socioeconomic rise. Even the ability of Japanese emigrants to speak the European languages of the surrounding societies in the Western Hemisphere and Australia was very limited during the first generation, which led the Japanese to concentrate in occupations where there was little or no need to master languages radically different from their own. Working together as agricultural laborers, fishermen, or farmers, or performing routine tasks as domestic servants with minimal need for a vocabulary in the local language, the first generation of Japanese overseas, the Issei, began the long movement up the occupational ladder. Second and later generations, at least partially familiar with the local language, and often no more than partially familiar with the Japanese language as well, not only rose further, but often in entirely different occupations, such as the educated professions. It was not the specific skills brought from Japan which produced the greatest economic success for Japanese emigrants, but their more general human capital in work habits, perseverance, social cohesion, and law-abiding patterns of life. These found their outlets in whatever economic and social opportunities were available in the countries in which they settled. Initially, the Japanese encountered not only nativist opposition, but even increasing opposition as their competition with the local populations pitted them first against other laborers and then against other farmers and businessmen as they rose into these occupational strata. Eventually, however, over a period of generations, their success in the economy and their social patterns as a group with low incidences of crime, violence, and other social pathologies made them more acceptable, both in the economy and socially. The Japanese as a group acquired a reputation for honesty and reliability, whether in Brazil, the United States, or Peru. None of this happened quickly or easily, or without major setbacks, of which internment during World War II was the principal tragedy in both Western Hemisphere nations and Australia. The post-war experience of the Japanese has been radically different from their pre-war experience, again both in the Western Hemisphere and in Australia. Once excluded under the White Australia policy, the Japanese were by the 1980s being encouraged to immigrate to Australia, though with little success. The prosperity of post-war Japan meant that there was no longer such economic pressure as once existed for the island's people to seek a living in other countries. Regional and neighborhood concentrations of Japanese dissolved in the United States and in Canada, partly as a result of the wartime internment experience. In post-war Toronto, where many Japanese lived, it became rare to find two Japanese families living in the same block. The role of Japan as a military power spared Japanese abroad some of the worst oppression suffered by the Chinese emigrants who preceded them to the United States and Canada, where a predominantly male Chinese population was left stranded overseas without their wives and families, and without prospects of acquiring wives from their homelands. Japan also took a more direct interest in the colonies set up under its auspices in Brazil. However, it is by no means clear that Japan was, on net balance, a continuing beneficial influence on the lives of Japanese emigrants overseas. The military aggressions of Japan in the 1930s and 1940s generated anti-Japanese sentiments in many countries, usually to the detriment of the Japanese living in those countries. The far greater acceptance of the Japanese overseas in the post-war era, after the fears and hostilities aroused by Japan's military threat had passed, suggests that hostility to the local Japanese was not purely racial or due simply to locally generated economic rivalry or social friction. The response of the Japanese overseas to the hostile attitudes and government policies directed against them tended to be pragmatic rather than emotional. Reforming the racism of the surrounding society was not a major preoccupation, perhaps because the Japanese themselves have been highly ethnocentric, whether in Japan or overseas, and so could hardly have been surprised to discover similar feelings in others. Such minorities in Japan as the Koreans, the Ainu, or even the social pariah group of Burakamin among the Japanese themselves are severely excluded from social interaction with most Japanese, and even Japanese Americans who settle in Japan tend to find themselves not accepted as true Japanese. Whatever the historical origins of such attitudes among the Japanese, This meant that Japanese emigrants overseas seldom dissipated their energies in attempts to morally regenerate the majority population in the countries in which they settled, since universal acceptance was not part of their own outlook. The remarkable reversal of public attitudes toward the Japanese over the years, especially in Australia, Peru, and the United States, suggests that behavior and performance are more effective ways of changing other people's minds than moral crusades or emotional denunciations. The behavior and performance of Japanese emigrants have certainly produced remarkable economic advancement in the most varied countries on three continents.